This is Maurice Jones-Drew, and you're listening to the What's Brewing Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for West Coast Bias, the show brought to you all the way from the best coast. It's the West Coast Bias, that is. Aw, yeah.
Hello, and welcome to West Coast Bias. I'm your host, Jake Merrifield, and I'm joined here by my good friend, Jamal Artist, at JamsPapa1015. Jamal, how are you doing?
Hey, West Coast Nation. Another year older, and another year more biased and crankier about my LA sports.
That's us. Yeah. Hey, good to see you, buddy. This is West Coast Bias on the What's Brewing Show Network. Three great shows on one great feed. We taped a kind of an all-timer What's Brewing symposium last night, at least the first 10 minutes of it. Jamal, sad you weren't here, but it got pretty wild, and I'm proud of that, and I'll stand by that. And if you can listen to the first 10 minutes of yesterday's What's Brewing symposium and you still want to listen to us, like, that's exactly what we're all about. And it has nothing to do with sports. It has nothing to do with UCLA. It's just, to me, some good old clean, dirty fun. And we appreciate you guys. So you also have the UCLA B team. I'm sure they'll publish an episode again at some point soon. But this is West Coast Bias, where we're talking about West Coast sports stuff. Really, right now, and until next week, we're going to be talking about Winning Time, the show about Jeff Perlman's book, Showtime, about the Lakers of the 80s, the Showtime Lakers. And we're going to get to that in just a moment, Jamal. But before we do that, please, we haven't done this in a while, but if you're enjoying the show, by all means, subscribe. If you're enjoying the show, by all means, give us a nice review. And if you don't like the show and you hate us, then just, stop listening and don't bother giving us a review, because we'd appreciate that. Constructive compliments only. Thank you very much. Now, Jamal, before we bring on the Godfather Jim Bendat to talk about episode 9 of Winning Time, we'll take care of all the basketball talk with that. Is there anything else going on right now? The Giants and the Dodgers are facing off. So far, the Dodgers got over on the Giants last night, 3-1,
great victory.
They've been playing pretty well, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, the Dodgers, they finished the month of April 13-7. Obviously, it was shortened. The month of April was shortened because of the whole lockout and then shortened spring training. People were, it's kind of weird. They're kind of like doing the whole ebb and flow, I believe, with the offense. Sometimes it's boom or bust. I got to go to a game.
Very good. Yeah, I saw the pictures.
Last Friday, the 29th.
Looking great.
Yeah, they beat the Tigers. It was for my birthday. They beat the Tigers 5-1. And then the next night, they could not do anything against the Tigers. In fact, they didn't score. So the game I went to, they scored in the first four innings. And then they didn't score again except for one run between Friday and Saturday. They only scored one run in the next, 13, 14 innings. So it's kind of been that kind of way for the Dodgers at the moment. Really boom or bust when it comes to the offense. But like I said last week, it's easier to get in the playoffs in Major League Baseball. The Dodgers will be there. I think the offense is going to take a while to come around because pitching has really been really good. And that happens when there's spring training even. Pitching is always usually ahead of the hitters. But with the shortened spring training, I think it's a little bit more pronounced with this Dodger team. And some of the other teams around the league. So, but trust me, folks, the Dodgers will be there in the end, even in a tough West where they're facing the Giants, who are in second, and the Padres, who are doing really well. But it was fun to be at the ballpark with family. If you're a parent like Jake and I are, when your kids are little, they usually can't handle these long games. My daughter knocked out. We took the kids specifically for fireworks night. And my daughter, knocked out in, the sixth inning because, as most people know, baseball is a long sport. And the sixth inning was, already, 2 hours into the game, and she was out. She had her popcorn. She got a little bit of ice cream. She got her pink Dodgers hat, and she was done. And then my favorite part, we get into the parking lot, Jake, and, our listeners. Dodger Stadium, horrible parking. To get in, to get out. Yeah, took us an hour to get out of the stadium.
Oh.
We don't know why. Our shortcut exit was weird. Everybody fell asleep in the car.
Your brand new car?
Yeah. Well, no, not yet.
Damn it! You hadn't gotten the new car?
No, we hadn't gotten the new car. Everybody
Son of a bitch. Was that the final nail in the old car's coffin?
Pretty much. Yeah. Everybody fell asleep in the car. So what did I listen to? I listened to a song, West Coast Bias. I got the whole, our last episode talking about winning time. Listened to the whole thing in the parking lot. Everybody asleep in the car. Nobody noticed. And then had to go a different way out to finally get home. And that's a very Dodger Stadium story in terms of like literally sitting in the parking lot for an hour because nobody's moving.
Were you listening at normal speed or at 2x speed?
Normal speed, folks. This is normal speed.
Why are you listening at normal speed?
I listen. I'm a...
Like, it should be like 1.5 at a minimum. I listen only at 2x speed.
I'm a crazy completist. Jake, I kid you not, some of the podcasts I listen to, I'm like a year behind because I cannot do...
Sarah.
Yeah, I have to listen to every episode of a podcast thoroughly all the way through. Doesn't matter what it is.
Well, I'm just saying, Jamal. I mean, like, you know, for fluffy sports talk like this, my rule is 2. For anything that's like I have to listen to, like, you know, political type stuff, politics would be like 1.5. And then, like, philosophy would have to be 1.25.
Right.
But, I mean, come on, Jamal. You can get so much more done if you just train that ear, buddy. Come on. What do you think about the Dodger pitching so far?
I mean, it's some of the best in the major leagues. The starters have done well. Clayton Kershaw seems to have found the fountain of youth. I wrote an article in the DodgersWay.com for the FanSided Network.
.com. Wait, you're on the... That's the FanSided Network?
Yeah.
Oh, so Castillo is your He's your boss.
Something has come across his way. Yeah, I'm writing about the Dodgers there. I wrote about how for the month of April, Clayton Kershaw pitched like an ace, even though at the beginning of the season I had said Walker Buehler was the ace of the Dodgers. He pitched like an ace, 3-0. He had his first start. He went almost a perfect game, 7 innings. You know, famously, he got pulled out, and that was a big debate about that. And because of people wanting to see him throw a perfect game. But, I mean, he's pitched really well. Walker Buehler struggled at the beginning, but he's had some good starts. Julio Urias has had some good starts. The guys that nobody thought the Dodgers, you know, guys like Tyler Anderson, Tony Gonsolin, Andrew Heaney before he got hurt, all these guys, people were questioning whether the Dodgers starting staff would be good enough. They've all done really well. As starters, and so they're one of the best teams pitching wise, and you know, in terms of offense, it's been the opposite, where it's boom or bust, and they're like more middling in terms of where they stand in the standings on their offensive side.
All right, well, and what'd you Kershaw broke the strikeout record,
right? Oh yeah, the other night, the Saturday
night, in a losing effort,
he broke the Dodgers all-time record, which is amazing when you think about the history of the Dodgers, 120 years plus as a team, all the great pitchers that have come through, and he's the top of the heap, the most strikeouts. He broke Don Sutton's Dodger record, and it's just a testament to the longevity of his career, the longevity with the Dodgers. And to me, it cemented the fact that he is probably the greatest Dodger pitcher of all time, even though a lot of people older than me would probably say it's still Sandy Koufax because he was so dominant for such a short period there. But I just think for longevity-wise, him being the ace for so long, all the things that he's done as a Dodger between the Cy Youngs, the MVP award, winning a World Series with them, he is, to me, the greatest Dodger pitcher, certainly of my lifetime and, in my opinion, in their history.
Of guys you've watched for sure, right?
Right. For sure. I mean, for sure. I mean, when you consider how young he was when he came on with the team, you know, and how well he developed and the leader that he is on the team and, you know, everything that comes with it, just being the best for so long and certainly of his peers, in my opinion, he has to be the greatest pitcher in their history.
All right. So now the last thing to talk about before we get to winning time, go Kings go or no go Kings go?
Well, they won their first game in the series 4-3 against the Edmonton Oilers. They're not favored because, you know, they you know, a lot of people didn't think they'd get to this point in terms of the playoffs. They're struggling tonight. They're down 2-0 at the moment. They just gave up a shorthanded goal, but they're on the road. They'll be coming home. I just think they're playing with, you know, house money. Nobody expected them to be this get this far. And here they are, they're in the playoffs, and they're giving it a tough time to a team that, if the Oilers lose this series, there's talk of people getting fired, trades being made, that kind of situation. So you know, anything can happen in playoff hockey. They could win this game and win the series eventually, or lose this game and win the series eventually. But it's great to be back in the playoffs for somebody. You know, the Clippers, the Lakers didn't make it for Crypto.com, Staples Center, whatever you want to call it. But it's nice that the Kings will be hosting some playoff hockey these next coming days.
Do you think we drink too much?
No, we don't drink too much. Men face reality. Women don't. That's why men need to drink.
I hate it when podcasters talk about what they're drinking.
What else am I going to drink, Bob? A fucking Fresca?
Hey, Jamal, usually we do this commercial on the What's Brewing Symposium, but, we had a drink tonight.
Yes,
you
know, we did.
I served you a nice cocktail in your cow glass over there. What, in fact, did you drink tonight?
I specifically asked for a Godfather drink.
Which is the wrong drink you asked for, because you really wanted a Milton Berle.
That's what it is, a Milton Berle. So I'm going to try to guess. I know that there's Cointreau and Amaretto, because you asked.
That's right.
Is this rye?
No, it's just whiskey.
Just
Woodford, Cointreau, Amaretto, and I stole it from Maggiano's. And the reason it's called the Milton Berle is because, and I served myself one too, so that's what I had too. And that's because Milton Berle, one of his old lines, and by the way, tied into Winning Time. He had a cameo in Winning Time last week.
Exactly.
Pretty rough cameo, by the way. But one of my favorite Milton Berle lines was, "Hey, if you steal a joke from me, it's been stolen twice."
Right.
And exactly. That's why I call this drink the Milton Berle, because I stole it from Maggiano's.
And it's one of the ones I enjoy. It's like the perfect cocktail. I don't know what it is.
It is very yummy.
It's just so good. They should be serving the Milton Berle in every bar, in my opinion.
I would have to agree with that. And so enjoy that one. Now, the reason I bring it up is because, of course, you can support the What's Brewing Show Network, West Coast Bias, the What's Brewing Symposium, the B Team. Not really a B Team, because I don't pay them nothing. But you can support the show by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/whatsbrewingshow, or just whatsbrewingshow.com. And for just $2 a month, you can send the What's Brewing Show Network into the future. And we appreciate your support. With that, you get access to our Slack feed, where some of the diehard faithful of the What's Brewing Show Network will talk to us via, you know, like Slack text, which is a lot of fun. You get a lot of contributions
there.
Oh,
yeah, that's great.
What up, Jack? What up, Dave? What up, all the rest of yous? Seamus, Shame Dog, all you guys, Nancy, we love you all, and everybody else I didn't shout out. But also, you get some bonus content from time to time. There's going to be a nice little What's Brewing Show After Dark on the feed coming up tonight, probably, and that'll be where my lovely wife, the lovely Sarah, joined the show, when we talk about going to concerts in the 90s out in the 909. So that's fun, I guess. And we get into some other stuff, too. Bill, as usual, loses control of his bodily functions, and I have a couple clips of that in there. So that's a lot of fun. So,
and, folks, I would like to say, not only am I a co-host on the What's Brewing Network, I'm also a member
Jamal, of
said Patreon.
That's right, group. You are. You don't really have to, but you do nonetheless.
But I'm going to nonetheless.
So for just $2 a month, you can help us, and we appreciate your support. Now, I think we should get to Winning Time, Episode 9. So let's bring on the Godfather. All right, joining us once again on the West Coast Bias Hotline is everyone's favorite retired public defender. Today, I think he was giving pearls of wisdom out to newly minted public defenders, and we love him for that. He's an author, Democracy's Big Day, available on Amazon. Go buy it now or after you're done listening to this. It's none other than the Sports Godfather, Jim Bendat. He's here to talk with us about episode 9 of Winning Time, an acceptable loss. Jimmy, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great, Jake. Hope you're doing well. And Jamal, hope you're doing fine, too.
Thanks, Jim. Glad to have you back on the show.
So we are here, all three of us, to talk about the penultimate episode of season 1 of Winning Time. And we were kind of speculating about where it was going to end up and where it was going to go. I don't remember last week what we had said about how far or how much this episode was going to cover. Did we think that it was going to get to the finals? Do we think it was going to get stuck in one of the playoff series?
I think we had mentioned that it was had to go to the playoffs at least, because just we read the titles and we figured the last episode had to cover the finals. So I think we had said at least through the playoffs.
Okay, well,
yes. In fact, I had mistakenly thought they would spend a bunch of time on the playoffs.
Yes.
Particularly the Seattle series, which was a mammoth series against the defending NBA champs. And they just brushed by it. They brushed by the Phoenix series and they brushed by the Seattle series. So that was a little surprising to me. One little oddity about the Seattle series I might mention. In those days, the Sonics played their home games at the King Dome, and they got big crowds. But the King Dome, I believe because of baseball, was unavailable for games 3 and 4.
You're absolutely right.
Of that series, and they wound up playing at Heck Edmondson Pavilion on the University of Washington campus.
Oh, wow.
And I remember at the time there was a lot of speculation that this could give the Sonics a big advantage because it's an intimate place and it's going to be loud and everybody's going to be against the Lakers. Didn't quite work out that way for Sia.
What was the Lakers won like 4-1, right? Is that what it was?
Yes, they did. So they lost the first game and then they basically, gentlemen sweep, right? They swept the rest. So they did win both games at Edmondson Heck Stadium. And I actually have those games on DVD, Jim. And it's an interesting thing to see because it's I believe the court is on risers, if I could be mistaken, or it's sunken. It's like some weird thing where like it doesn't look like a real court, and it's very small. I think at that time, because it was for the Washington Huskies basketball team, I think it only held like 8,000 people for an NBA playoff game. That's crazy.
This is kind of a sidetrack.
I think that's right. Yet, you're ready for this? Throwing a little bit of NCAA basketball Final Four history here.
Yes.
Now, of course, we know that the Final Four is always held in big domes. Well, in 1949 and 1952, the NCAA Final Four was held at Heck Edmondson Pavilion in Seattle.
Oh, wow. How the heck did they end up getting there?
Because the King Dome was unavailable. Yeah. And I believe what's now they call it the Key Arena. I forget what they called
it. Yeah, Key Arena is what it was when the Sonics
played, right?
You know, well, even in the earlier days, it was called the Seattle Center Coliseum.
That was not available, I believe, because of some other commitment, either the circus or the ice capades. It was something commercial where they couldn't play there either.
Well, no, I'm talking about Jim's trivia. Godfather, do you know why would the Final Four in the 40s and, you know, late 40s and early 50s end up at, you know, on Washington's campus? Was it because Washington was in it, or was it like a random neutral site?
Just as they do now, the NCAA Final Four has always been shipped around to different venues. Mm. Now, in the early days, it was held many times in Kansas City, and in the 1940s, many, many times at Madison Square Garden. But then they started shipping it around. So in 49, it was in Seattle. In 50, it was back in Madison Square Garden. 1951, it was at the University of Minnesota campus. 52, back to Seattle, University of Washington campus. In 1956, it was at Northwestern's small little 8,000-seat arena.
Oh, wow. So they're really just showcasing
that
all
kind
around.
That kind of thing happened in those days.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's good. See, that's why we have the Sports Godfather on, because he could give us little nuggets like that. Okay, well, anywho, the actual show, you know, episode 9, kind of zooms through the playoffs in the last, 15 minutes of the episode, or even less than that. Let's start though just right at what the title of the show is, an acceptable loss. We were kind of, before the show started, we were kind of speculating about what that could refer to, because I was thinking, you know, I don't know. I mean, does it apply to, you know, Mama Buss? I mean, does it apply to Spencer Haywood? Those are the big losses. Does it apply to Jack McKinney? You know, I think, you know, my eyeballing it, I feel like McKinney has to be the answer there, because he's the only one of these losses that really feels acceptable to me. But what do you guys think?
That, I agree. That makes sense. I mean, because they've chosen to use the adjective acceptable.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be all that acceptable that that Jesse Buss dies. I don't know if it's really all that acceptable that Spencer Haywood is kicked off the team, which didn't, in fact, happen in reality quite then, particularly given how this show ends.
Yes.
With Haywood wanting to kill off the rest of the team with his hitman, very bizarre. So I guess it must be McKinney, but that it was sort of a sad loss that he's out. Acceptable seems to be a weird word to use.
I honestly, when we read the titles last week, I thought it was, they were talking about McKinney only because of what in, you know, for the history of real life that Dr. Buss basically essentially fired McKinney in favor of Paul Westhead because he thought that you really couldn't change you couldn't change midstream, basically, going into this last part of the season and into the playoffs. So, you know, having thought about it now, it does feel like that they're talking about Jack McKinney, but it could talk about all three people. But like Jim said, you know, you can't really accept losing a mother nor having to kick off a player. But it just feels like that's where the episode revolves around in terms of the three arcs that we'll discuss. And so that's why the title fits. There's a lot of loss, basically.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Now, let's kind of focus in on, you know, the different threads here. Let's start with the one of, you know, the last days of Jesse Buss. This, of course, is, at least to some degree, made up out of whole cloth because she had actually passed away in real life back in, like, 77, you said,
yes,
Jamal?
Yeah,
77, 76. And so this is something that kind of gets shoehorned into the chronology of the show. And even with, you know, at the very end, the very, you know, sad kind of juxtaposition of her in the hospital and when they pull the plug and the Lakers, you know, zooming through the playoffs pretty much. As far as Sally Field goes, and this is our farewell to her, I imagine she could show up in some flashbacks or something going forward. But what do you guys think of her performance this season? And, you know, I guess it's understandable, given how good she was in the show, that they were like, well, we need to shoehorn this character into the narrative, I guess. What do you think?
Every time Sally Field was in a scene, she was just amazing. I mean, she was really sort of an MVP of this season because she just brought so much to everything that she did in portraying Jesse Buss and really helping the audience understand that a different part of Dr. Buss, and obviously the character played by John C. Reilly. So I think for the season, you know, the fact that we lose her at the end of episode 9, it had to happen because you didn't want it to be some weird situation where, like, the last episode of the season, they're winning championship and then, you know, Buss isn't there or whatever. You know, it couldn't have worked. So even though they fictionally made this character up here at this point of Dr. Buss's life, I mean, she was just amazing throughout the whole season. I wouldn't be surprised if she got nominated for something, you know, guest actress in a miniseries or one of those kind of things.
I agree. I mean, she won a couple of Oscars years ago, and now she's in her later years, and she's still got it. Still a great actress, and it was just a joy watching her every time she came on.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, and you know, I think she was also necessary to the plot to kind of allow a mechanism to flesh out the relationship between Jerry and Jeannie as well, and having that, you know, that older third generation there, and you see the relationship between Jesse and Jerry, and then how that kind of, you know, just the whole thing, all the dynamics, that was very, very cool and necessary, and obviously very poignant part of the show as he's kind of coming to accept, Jerry is coming to accept the fact that his mom is dying, and then actually they have that last night together, and then she ends up passing. That was certainly one of the more kind of tear-jerky moments of the show. Along with that, Jerry is also having to struggle with the decision of, does he bring McKinney back, or does he stick with Westhead and Riles? And, you know, obviously we know how it turned out. He ends up staying with Westhead and they win the title and all that stuff. But what do you think about how they, created this drama of, you know, what's going to happen and how do you feel it jived with real life, I guess? Jimmy, what do you think?
I thought they did it well, and maybe it wasn't too different from what we saw. Maybe. I'm not really sure what went on behind the scenes, but clearly, in the end, Buss did the right thing. I've come to understand from a few other people who were around at that time that McKinney was even more out of it than the show portrays. That he just didn't remember people's names, and there was just no way he could continue to coach because of his motor skills just weren't there.
Yeah. My understanding is that there is a story, and I can't remember if I read it in the Jeff Perlman book Showtime or if I read it in another book about the Laker history, but that Jack McKinney, that scene where, I don't know, it didn't play out quite like it was where Buss shows up, you know, at the door with a bottle of champagne McKinney can't recognize him. But there was a situation where Jack McKinney could not recognize Jerry Buss in some sort of interaction, and that was why Jerry Buss decided that he couldn't bring back Jack McKinney. It's you know, we've talked about it on this show. It is tragic the way things turned out for Jack McKinney, but when you watch it played out the way it did in this last episode, it's just really, really unfortunate. I thought the Julianne Nicholson, the woman who plays his wife Cranny, I mean, that whole interaction was just heartbreaking because she's the one who's kind of like, hey, man, I'm the one who moves the kids. I'm the one who's has been with you at every step of the way in this journey, and always believed in you. And, you know, for it to fall apart the way it did for them, it's just really it's really sad to have watched and seen it on this show.
I do like the way they constructed the arcs in that in the beginning of the show, the first few episodes when McKinney first gets hired, and you have Jerry West kind of sniffing around and trying to, you know, he's already resigned, but you can tell that he didn't really want to resign. He still wants to be involved, and he's kind of like shoehorning himself in there. And Buss is giving him a hard time about being part of the team, and you know, he's like, you're not one of us. You resigned. You left. And McKinney's giving him the cold shoulder too. And now as we get back to the end of the season and all these things coming together, Buss goes to West and he's like, all right, come on back in. I need your help. And even though West ultimately doesn't make the decision for him, you know, he's obviously being invited back in the fold. And at the same time, McKinney goes from giving him the cold shoulder to actually going in there and trying to lobby for himself with West. And it's a much different, you know, situation. So I like how that they kind of played out those arcs. I also liked how, Riley and Westhead could have taken the low road and they could have said, look, this guy, and they would have been justified in doing it too. The guy physically, like the Godfather said, wasn't able to do the job, but they're like, look, we shouldn't have to say that. Like, these guys making decisions should be able to freaking see that. And also balance that with the fact that we've won 40 games, you know, and led the team to the best record in the league or the second best record in the league or whatever. So I did like how that kind of played out. And also very fortunate timing, of course, with the, you know, him showing up with the champagne or whatever, and then
right.
oh, never mind. Here, enjoy this, folks. So that was. I thought that was pretty cool how that played out. With the other thing that I kind of didn't bring up was the opening scene of the show is Claire Rothman asking Buss to allow Jeannie to come on staff. What do you guys think about that? And like, at what point does Jeannie actually join the Lakers staff? Like in the capacity that she had for, you know, most of those years.
I don't remember, but it seems like she was always around.
Right.
In an official capacity, it would have been in the late 80s for Jeannie. She did, I don't know if Jim remembers this, but the Jerry Buss owned an indoor soccer team. There was an indoor soccer league in the U.S. There was no outdoor soccer at some point after the mid-80s. And he basically put Jeannie in charge of that at like 21, if I remember correctly, while I still think at USC or maybe just graduated from USC. She did work with Claire Rothman, but it was much later. She was kind of sort of a mentor towards her in terms of on the business side of the Lakers and the forum, that kind of situation. But it feels like, you know, it's another one of those things where I think that the producers kind of shoehorned in this story earlier than it really happened, just to sort of kind of have Jeannie there as a character.
The funny thing that I didn't realize until we were talking about before the show was that I was figuring that at some point during this segment of Winning Time, we're going to get some little thing of before she joins the Lakers, she's like fresh out of SC and she does a spread for Playboy in like the college girl section or whatever. I didn't realize she didn't appear in Playboy until the freaking 90s. Like, that's to me crazy.
And she was a, you know, an executive in the NBA.
Yeah. That did you realize that timeline was there, Godfather? I you know, is that
I
in your collection?
I didn't remember if it was the 90s or late 80s. I remember she went out with some guy who'd been, I think, an Olympic volleyball player.
Which
I remember that was a big romance for a while. I'm not sure if it was volleyball, but that's my recollection. And so she was often in the headlines here or there, not necessarily for executive roles, but, you know, for her romantic interests and for the Playboy thing. So, you know, she was getting herself out there, no doubt about it.
Wowza. So the other big plot line that we had in this episode was the Spencer Haywood stuff. And obviously that ends with a giant kind of cliffhanger, him trying to get a gun to go, you know, kill all the Lakers. But the way,
what the hell was that?
That was crazy, right? I mean, and it, Jamal, you know, as the reader of Showtime, is there any basis of
yes
truth in any of this? Explain what the context for this is.
Yeah, apparently he thought he could. It wasn't the Lakers. It was Paul Westhead specifically.
Ah,
and the plot was to cut his brakes so that it looked like an accident, and basically kill Paul Westhead. He had some. I think Spencer Haywood was from Detroit. In real life, and he had some friends in Detroit, and he was going to hire them to put a hit on Paul Westhead, and then he called it off. Obviously, we don't see that at the end of the show. It's left as a cliffhanger. I don't know if they'll address it later, but
yeah, and they kind of created it a little bit differently than
right.
Wow. So I mean, you know, as the Godfather well knows, I'm sure he's defended his share of criminal conspiracies. I mean, this is, you know, hitman for hire, that whole number,
and that's according to Haywood telling this story to Jeff Perlman in the Showtime book. So I don't know how much validity there is, but
wowza,
he's, you know, wow, he's sober now and has been for many years. So I believe it. So yeah, that's part of this storyline.
Well, obviously, I mean, Godfather and your experience over the years, your professional experience, is it possible for someone who is on crack to make poor decisions, especially at critical moments of your life?
I would say that's very possible.
Yeah, right. Gee whiz, man. So it is interesting how they change it for the show.
Right.
And, you know, and they go from, you know, a grand conspiracy in Detroit to, you know, to just, you know, going to get a gun from some guy in freaking Inglewood, you know, or you know, wherever he is, Torrance or East Torrance or something. How do you guys, all the stuff about him kind of, you know, he had two fall-offs in this episode. Where Kareem kind of confronts him, and then Kareem has to struggle with whether or not he's going to go with the, you know, he has the deciding vote basically. And I thought that was a really, you know, it was a kind of a beautiful set of scenes where Kareem's kind of struggling with that. How'd you guys feel that played out on the screen?
I agree with you, Jake. That's probably some of the best acting that was done in this episode between the players deciding his fate, Solomon Hughes as Kareem confronting Spencer Haywood, played by Wood Harris. The story that Spencer tells while talking to Kareem before he gets this final vote basically told to him. That whole situation was just, it was harrowing. It was an interest. It was, it really was more about the acting in that scene, and amazing for Wood Harris, a veteran actor, and Solomon Hughes in his first big role to sort of play off each other in that final scene between the two of them. I thought it was some of the best acting.
Yeah, tremendous acting and just tremendous casting too. I mean, think about Solomon Hughes. Here's a guy you say he's never acted before. He's a natural.
Absolutely.
And he looks like young Kareem. He sounds like him. He's got that soft-spoken nature, but can be tough at times. Just so well acted.
Yeah, and like I said, and the way that it plays out where he has the final vote and he's, you know, he pretty much, you know, chooses the team over Spencer. And, you know, you get the arguments like, you know, Norm saying like, look, this guy is troubled and you know, the team what needs to win. And the other guys are having a little more compassion. Jamal's namesake, one of them. And you definitely see how they're torn with it. But I thought that played out pretty well. All right, just some odds and ends here. Getting back to the playoff run that was represented, you know, we talked about the juxtaposition of Jesse Buss's, you know, final moments with the Lakers zooming through the playoffs, beating the Suns and the Supersonics. And I would say that was a very beautiful scene, other than the fact that the soundtrack that they chose was very triggering for me, especially after I was just at the Reina Troy wedding over the weekend and got to see the 10-piece Trojan marching band play Tusk for me live in front of a bunch of Trojans where I had to hear the whole UCLA sucks chant. Having to watch that again on, you know, the very next day, Tusk over the Lakers montage, that was it was a little triggering for me. What did you guys think of how they you know, did the Laker montage for the playoffs? Obviously, it was brief, like we said. Any other moments that they missed out on other than, like you said, the great Supersonic series?
Well, I was going to say, I felt you know, the North Valley and where the Godfather, I could hear you guys probably kicking something when they were playing Tusk, because they've done great with all the musical cues, and I just knew that one was going to get to you. I just knew it.
I was not very happy with that.
Yeah. The worst Fleetwood Mac song ever.
Absolutely. And it's, yeah. And I was there at the wedding, and you know, and that's, they start playing, and Sarah's like, she loves Fleetwood Mac. And I'm like, we can't like the song. The song sucks. And she's like, why? And I said, just wait about 15 seconds. You're going to find out why. It's like, oh, now I get it. You know, as soon as they got to the champ part.
I went to one of those weddings a couple years ago when the SC band showed up. But it's a tough thing to deal with.
It really is. I did get my revenge of the Godfather. You'll love this, and that the bride has four brothers, and I gave each one of the brothers a What's Brewing Symposium T-shirt, which they immediately rocked, and we got some pictures and tweeted them out, and they are now converted What's Brewing fans. They've foregone and turned their backs on Reign of Troy. So I did make a little bit of progress. That was nice.
Good work.
Now, one of the other things I loved was one of my favorite characters with just little one-liners is Landsberger. And he had a great one-liner in the last episode. I don't remember what it was. And then in this episode, after Jamal Wilkes kind of awakens Spencer Haywood, who's zoning out, in the middle of practice, Haywood jumps up and yells that
he's meditating,
and he storms off the court. And Landsberger comes in with a, he's pretty angry for a guy that's meditating. I thought that just kind of steals the show. I love Landsberger. Like, and by the way, if you Wikipedia Mark Landsberger and you look at the pictures that come up, it is
pretty good.
Dead ringer for the actor that's portraying him. So that's another one where they got it exactly right. The last thing to talk about, probably maybe, I don't know, the most important, I don't know, maybe, shocking, certainly, Jamal, your namesake makes quite a cameo. Or something, a part of it makes quite a cameo in this episode. In the background, we get Jamal Wilkes and walking out of the shower.
Quite the debut, Jamal Jr.
You should feel proud that this is a man you're named after, I suppose.
Yes, quite proud, I think. I wonder if it's, I'm not surprised that he hasn't been one of the Laker veterans who's spoken out about the series, because they've been pretty good to
him. They've been very complimentary towards him.
Yeah, he's the whole time.
No, Magic, don't go with the hookers and blow.
Right.
And then,
Zastro. Don't go with Zastro.
Yeah, don't go with Zastro. Who needs to walk through the shower? Oh, yeah, I'll do it. That's fine. That's me. Yeah. Certainly Jamal is getting,
he's not
go Bruins, by the
all.
Way. Yeah,
exactly.
He's not complaining at all. Yeah, Godfather, any thoughts?
The scene spoke for itself.
Absolutely.
In the law, we say res ipsa loquitur.
Absolutely. Itself.
Oh, yes, my goodness. Yes. All right. Well,
How about Larry Bird?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Godfather, thank you very much. I need to write this stuff down. So the other part about the playoffs is we get this wonderful scene where the Lakers realize that they don't have to play the Celtics. They get to play the 76ers, return to Dr. J. Magic's going to get his, a chance to get his revenge on Dr. J. But also, Magic's looking at the TV, and we get one of these great breaks where Larry Bird, talks to Magic from the TV. We get a lot of these this season. And what does he say, guys?
He says, same time next year, MF-er.
Yeah, same time. We can curse Jamal, but that's okay, you motherfucker. What did you guys think overall of the Larry Bird character this season? I thought it was, especially after coming off a couple of the documentaries of those two at that time, I thought it was pretty good. I like his characterization.
Well, I like the fact that it drives the Boston Homer hack Bill Simmons crazy. Every time he talks about this show, he can't stand the way the Celtics are portrayed. And I love it,
As evil? I mean, what can he?
Well,
how can he really take any?
His complaint is,
as a horrible racist place. I mean, this is stuff we know about Boston, isn't it?
That Larry Bird is this monotone person that didn't have to say a lot, that he wasn't walking around with chaw in his mouth. And it was like, no, that's pretty accurate for 1980. I'm sorry.
Yeah, wasn't he?
Yes,
I thought so.
Pretty accurate for 1980. I've seen some of his interviews from those old CBS NBA on CBS shows, and the lighthearted Larry Bird that we'd get later on, who's more willing to give a quote and talk about Magic and Jordan and Isaiah and those guys when he was playing. That in 1979, 1980, that Larry Bird did not exist. I'm sorry, Bill Simmons. You can get mad all you want, but he just didn't exist.
Yeah, suck it, sports guy. Godfather, what do you think about Bird?
To me, it didn't ring totally true that Bird would be such a prick.
Ah.
He was just more of a
off-putting,
just a guy from Indiana, the hick from French Lick.
Yeah,
you know, and didn't speak much. And here he's very vocal and very, very vulgar. So it surprised me. But can I tell a little
absolutely
story?
Yes.
I don't think I've mentioned this before, but I'm going to tell it now because it's right in the same time period. During this period, 1980 to 83, I was working in Inglewood. I was at the Inglewood Courthouse, so I'm right near the Forum. And I'd go to a number of games here and there, including those NBA Finals of 1980. Well, the next season, 1980-81 season, the Celtics came in for a regular season game, and a friend of mine named Bill McKinney and I got a couple of tickets and
no relation, and right?
Went to the game after work.
Yeah.
Now Bill McKinney probably still is, if he hasn't retired, a great lawyer, African American, and knows basketball right and left, and we'd always talk about it. We went to the game together. So in this particular game, Bird goes off. 36 points, 21 rebounds.
Wow.
Can't be stopped, and the Celtics won handily. And toward the end of the game, Bill turns to me and says, "You know, you white boys aren't too bright, but you sure can play basketball."
Touche, right? That's pretty good. I like that. Oh, man. So, Godfather, you know, you're a big defender of Larry Bird, apparently, then, on this particular thing. And I understand that argument. But as far as the betrayal overall of the Celtics, even if it's completely untrue, you're all in favor of them portraying the Celtics as the evil empire, terrible, horrible people, place, and thing, and all that stuff, right?
And then some.
Exactly.
And that, for me, that goes way back. That goes back to the early 60s, when the Lakers first came here in their second year. Lakers played the Celtics in the finals, 1962 finals. I'm 13 years old, and I watched game 7. Oh, and the Lakers had a chance. In fact, the Lakers even led 3-2 after winning game 5 in Boston.
Ouch.
Now, Lakers come home for game 6 with a chance to wrap it up at home. They blow it. They have to go back to Boston for game 7. It's a nip-and-tuck affair. It goes to overtime only because Frank Selvey misses a shot at the buzzer. Game goes into overtime, and then the Celtics win. And I've hated the Celtics ever since.
Oh my God! Well, who can blame you? Which game was it where they lost on the ball that bounces high and like just kind of falls in?
Game 7, 1969 Finals.
Ugh. Right.
That was Don
Nelson.
But some
people think that ended the game. It didn't end the game because the whole 1969 Game 7 is on YouTube.
Ah.
And you can that shot by Don Nelson was about a minute to go in the game. It increased the Celtics' lead, and they held on for the last minute. But when you see highlights these days, it almost looks like it's a buzzer beater. That's not the way it was.
Oh, very good. Okay, well, you know, Godfather, we still have you on the phone. We're not going to keep you too much longer. But let's transition just into some modern Laker talk because the Lakers are still there. They don't have a coach.
Still there.
They might not have, you know, they might change a roster. Like, have you guys heard any of the news about the prospective coaches out there?
Yeah.
They're going to Phil Jackson for advice, which, you know, I'm not really mad at, I guess.
I have a problem with that.
Is there anybody out there?
I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, okay. Does anybody have a preference of who a coach for them would be at this point?
The story
Or does it even matter? I don't think it matters.
The stories coming out now are, you know, before the playoffs started, it was Doc. It was Doc Rivers. It was Quinn Snyder. And Nick Nurse, you know, Nick Nurse and Quinn Snyder are out of the playoffs. Doc Rivers is still in it, probably going to be out, though. The 76ers just lost to Miami tonight. Now they're down 2-0. They still don't have Joel Embiid coming back. But now the stories that came out these last couple days, Godfather, you have Darvin Ham, who's an assistant with Milwaukee, who's considered a prospective coach for a lot of teams. It seems that the Lakers have reached out to talk to him, permission from Milwaukee to talk to him. And then they asked permission to talk to Adrian Griffin, who's a former pro, you know, point guard, played many years in the NBA, and is, I believe, with the Nets, and they asked permission to talk to him. So those are the kind of guys that they're seemingly in their kind of radar to coach the team. So guys who are head coaches and these, you know, prospective assistants who everybody thinks should step up and be a head coach.
Godfather, do you think it matters who coaches next year? Are they just going to be a train wreck, or do you think they're going to bounce back and have a nice season?
It all depends on what personnel moves they make in the offseason. I mean, it's been proven that you can change a team around for the better, or you can change a team around for the worse, as we saw this season. So you got to make the personnel moves. You got to somehow put together a team with chemistry, something that they lacked terribly this season. I mean, getting Russell Westbrook, people were excited about it, but it did not work. Just didn't work. So they're going to have to work on that chemistry angle, and then you never know.
No doubt. All right. Well, Jimmy, I wanted to keep you on the line long enough for the Dodgers to take the lead against the Gigantes. Fourth inning, Dodgers up 2-1. They still got no outs, and the Dodgers have first and second. And so hopefully they'll extend this lead, and we can end the night on a happy note. But, Jim, as always, it's great to talk to you. And next week we have the season finale. Of Winning Time. What's this one called, Jamal? Do you remember?
Oh, crap. Something about the Promised Land. Promised Land.
Yes. So I imagine we're going to have an NBA title, and I imagine we're going to see the iconic Magic playing all five positions. We're going to see Kareem getting hurt. We're going to see some struggle therein. We're going to see Westhead and Riley empowered now, and it should be a fun show. I wonder what seeds they're going to sow for season two. Any speculation on any of that before we sign off?
I'm just looking forward to it. I hope they spend a decent amount of time on the actual games.
Me too.
Yeah, I doubt it. It was a pretty dramatic series. Game three, when the Lakers went into Philly and won. Game four, Dr. J makes his famous shot. Game five was a fantastic game at the Forum, with Kareem scoring 40 points, even including, I believe, about 14 of those after he got injured. And of course, game six, when he didn't even make the trip to Philadelphia. So, great series. Very memorable. Can't wait.
Yeah, and I think that we are set up for them to have plenty of basketball stuff going on, because now we've trimmed off a couple of plot lines. I mean, there's no more. McKinney should be done. We should be, you know, obviously Jesse Buss dying. That's kind of played its course out. So we really just have the basketball, the Spencer, Kareem getting hurt, Magic, you know, basically minting himself as a, you know, budding all-time great. You know, so hopefully that's what it is.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. I would agree with you. I think the way they've cut off the three plot lines we discussed tonight makes it so that the series can focus on the real life drama of this series. As Jim mentioned, how close it was, and obviously the story of Magic being this 20-year-old and willing this team to a championship when Kareem got hurt. And I am looking forward to that. And I'm hoping that, you know, that this episode ends with some sowing of the seeds, as Jake mentioned, for a season two still revolving around Showtime, because there's plenty of drama left for the Lakers in the Showtime era, especially in that the 81 season and then the 82 season, so I hope that we get that in season two. And certainly, I want to see Slickback Riles eventually, and the whole turmoil of the loss to the Celtics and then finally overcoming the Celtics. I think that definitely has to be included in the next coming seasons, for sure.
All right. Well, Jimmy, as always, it's great talking to you. We will see you next week. And Jamal, what do we say?
We're the West Coast. We're the best coast. We are West Coast Bias.
The West Coast Bias.
We place a ball on the West Coast.